I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this lovely Thursday, the 22nd of May. In Milwaukee last week, Republican and Democratic elected office holders, scholars, public policy experts participated in a conference at Marquette University that was based on the Dividing Line series. We've talked about it with Craig Gilbert. It was a major project written by Craig, and it ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. High political segregation. Democrats and Republicans living in different communities. What happens as a result of that was one of the areas that was examined at that conference, and it's the focus of our conversation this hour with one of the participants in the conference, who is also one of Craig's sources for his series. Catherine Levine Einstein is with us, assistant professor of political science at Boston University. Her research and teaching interests include American public policy, racial and ethnic politics, political geography and politics and policy. She's working on a book now, Divided Regions, Race, Political Segregation, and the Fragmentation of American Metropolitan Policy. She studied Milwaukee, among other cities, and she also happens to be from Milwaukee, so she has special expertise in this community. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Catherine. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Cooperation among metropolitan jurisdictions, she writes, could help address critical local challenges. And they are potentially attractive to both disadvantaged and affluent metropolitan residents. So why don't they happen? We certainly think that you probably have thoughts on that, and we'll welcome your phone calls during the course of this hour. Professor Levine Einstein, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So you grew up in Milwaukee, right?
I did. I grew up on the east side of Milwaukee.
All right. So you have special understanding of this region, which we will talk about. Tell me about how regional coordination could be attractive to disadvantaged and to affluent residents. How so?
So I think the more obvious one is for sort of the disadvantaged urban poor. People who advocate for regionalism say that it can be a way to provide things like mass transit links that allow the urban poor to get to jobs that are disproportionately located in the suburbs. It can be a way to provide regional affordable housing opportunities that, again, allow these disadvantaged individuals to access more affordable housing closer to job opportunities. And it can also even be a way in some metropolitan areas to redistribute tax bases and improve urban services in areas that are cash-strapped. But it's not just something that can benefit areas that are home to disproportionate concentrations. The urban poor can also be beneficial to affluent communities. So, for example, just using mass transportation, better mass transit links could also help people in, say, Waukesha County who are commuting downtown and stuck in traffic on I-94. So there's that benefit. In addition, you can also look at things like sustainability initiatives that can help protect homeownership values in outlying communities and protect some sort of overeager developers. And finally, regionalism can help solve issues related to externalities from regional competition. So it can prevent municipalities from competing with each other to provide, say, tax breaks to developers and sort of low regulation zoning laws.
And when you talk about high political segregation getting in the way of some kind of regional cooperation, all that you mentioned here makes a lot of sense. What do you mean by high political segregation, and how does it manifest itself in a lack of region, and why does it manifest itself into a lack of regional cooperation?
So political segregation is when Democrats are disproportionately living in neighborhoods with other Democrats and Republicans are clustered with other Republicans. And so in somewhere like Milwaukee, the way this would manifest itself is the city of Milwaukee is a very heavily Democratic place. And the WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington, tend to be home to really heavily Republican individuals. And so you have these heavily Republican outlying communities, and you have these heavily Democratic urban areas and inner core suburbs. And what happens is the political leaders of these communities simply struggle to find common ground as a consequence of their political differences. They have really sharply distinct political preferences, and as a consequence, really struggle to agree on things like mass transportation or water politics or affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. It has been a complaint among many in the city of Milwaukee for years now that people in the suburban area don't realize how important Milwaukee is. Obviously, a lot of people in those suburban areas, if you've mentioned this in your articles, come into the city of Milwaukee to work, or they come to the ballet, or they come to plays. It's a cultural center in addition to being a work center, isn't it, for a lot of suburbanites?
Oh, absolutely. So it's certainly an important work center and an important cultural center. But even as jobs move out to the suburbs and, you know, Milwaukee becomes a slightly less central work destination for a lot of suburban residents, there's the broader issue. We know as social scientists that places that are more segregated and more unequal show lower mobility and lower economic growth over time. And so as a metropolitan area, having that kind of high level of inequality and high level of segregation long term is going to be an economic drag on the metropolitan area, even if jobs increasingly move out to the suburbs. These communities simply can't operate in isolation of the city of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look at the property tax base, and it's not as rich as it would be in other communities because you have a lot more people who are poor who live here, right?
Absolutely. And if you just think of other places that have struggling urban cores surrounded by suburbs that are doing better, Detroit, I think, is probably the most prototypical example. It's hard to imagine the Detroit metropolitan area really entering any sort of meaningful recovery in a long-term sense without the city of Detroit being pulled up. So there is this regional connectivity that the suburbs cannot expect to sort of continue to see wealth and economic growth while the city of Milwaukee struggles and stagnates.
I know you spent a lot of time on Milwaukee and Detroit, but you also looked at our neighbor, Minneapolis, and you did look at other areas, metro areas, yeah, where they do have mass transit and perhaps more regional cooperation. Which cities are those metro areas, and why do they have more cooperation?
So Minneapolis is a sort of prototypical example for people who study urban politics. They have a very strong regional government there, regional mass transit. They even have tax-based sharing, which is probably something unthinkable
yes,
to residents of metropolitan
right,
Milwaukee. And just for listeners who don't know, the regional tax-based sharing there works in that taxes actually get redistributed in that metropolitan area, that wealthier communities
Amazing.
Pay some proportion of their taxes into a common pot that are then redistributed to the less affluent communities. And, you know, it changes from year to year which communities get more than they give and which give more than they get. But overall, it's been a system that seems to work for a lot of communities in metropolitan Minneapolis. And why does it work in places like Minneapolis and not Milwaukee? I have found in my research that the places that tend to be less politically segregated tend to be more homogenous white communities with fairly low levels of racial segregation. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be this incredibly tight link between racial segregation and political segregation.
Mm-hmm. You also looked at places like New Orleans. Are we comparable to New Orleans in any way, or are they very different places that they have very little, at least mass transit in that area, very little regional cooperation?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, New Orleans is, at least in terms of political segregation levels, by some metrics, something of a peer to Milwaukee.
Is it?
So I want to stress, Milwaukee is one of the most politically segregated areas in the North. New Orleans definitely has a higher level of political segregation. It is certainly more politically polarized than Milwaukee. The South does have a uniquely high level of political polarization. But that said, they are both highly politically polarized places that see a similar sort of fragmented regional politics. As you pointed out, in New Orleans, the mass transit system is extraordinarily fragmented. the suburban Jefferson Parish, which is a very white, very conservative county, and Orleans Parish, which is heavily Democratic and largely African-American, actually run their own transit systems there. And those transit systems operate essentially in isolation with no transfer points, different token systems.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, maps that don't really link to each other. So it's really, and this is not just a problem to people who live in New Orleans, but potentially a problem to tourists. The New Orleans airport is actually located in Jefferson Parish. And so if you were a tourist who wanted to take a bus to New Orleans and wanted to use public transit as opposed to an airport shuttle, there are some significant obstacles to that in New Orleans.
Yeah. Let's go back to, because this is an important point, too, we don't pay attention to. There is much more emphasis on local governments and state governments taking care of all of the planning of areas like mass transit and other important areas, because the federal government is no longer doing that. Is that right?
Absolutely. And so that's actually a big reason why a lot of scholars and policymakers alike are talking about regionalism in the first place. You know, with the federal government devolution, and particularly during the Reagan era retrenchment, though it actually started a bit before Reagan, we see a huge cut in federal urban spending and increasing responsibility for state and local governments. And so as a consequence, there's been this idea that if we're going to solve these metropolitan challenges, it's going to fundamentally be the responsibility of local and state governments to try to make up what the federal government has cut back.
Mm-hmm. What I don't understand, and I wonder if it's just such political polarization here, that you've reached a point where you don't want to help a community, and you mentioned the water wars in Milwaukee, which is very interesting. You don't want to help another community with its tax base or help the, because you feel that it's a democratically run place, and so it's got a different ideology, and because your politics are different than our conservative Republican politics, we don't want anything to do with you. I know that's oversimplification, but when you look at how it could benefit suburban people who are coming into this city to work and people in this city who really need to get jobs, it's hard to figure out why there wouldn't be a spirit of cooperation unless ideology is very much at play here.
Absolutely, and I think one of the really big ways that ideology plays an important role is, it makes people who are in these more affluent suburban communities think of urban communities as these poorly run fiscal drags. You know, it's the
right.
Democratic tax and spend mentality,
mm-hmm.
and so they don't want to get dragged into that. And on the other side, you know, there certainly is, in a lot of the communities I've studied, a democratic mistrust of these suburban communities. And so it's not like the center cities are just sort of waiting with open arms for suburban cooperation. There's certainly mistrust on both sides because of these sharply different preferences.
You also point to a place like Santa Fe. Can we learn anything from Santa Fe? They're starting to do a little bit more cooperating.
Right. And so one of the things I talk about in my own research with Santa Fe is while they are a highly politically polarized place, they were actually able to implement a regional mass transit system, and this is largely because of the activism of the Democratic governor at the time, Bill Richardson. And so I think there is a role not just for state-level officials like governors or state legislators, but also people who are more insulated from local political pressures. So I'm thinking of things like unelected bureaucrats, or even community and business leaders, people who are able to potentially look past these ideological divisions, who don't have to worry about getting reelected, to be able to work together with their surrounding municipalities, with their colleagues who are in other cities. One of the things that actually came out at the Marquette Law Conference and listening to a lot of the political leaders talk about the challenges associated with regional cooperation was just that there are potential real political liabilities to working with municipalities who don't share those political views. And so some of the suburban leaders actually mentioned that there could be some real political drawbacks to being publicly associated with the city of Milwaukee. And that's something that an unelected bureaucrat or a business leader does not need to face because they aren't necessarily as held directly accountable by voters.
So you'd rather get your water from Oak Creek than Milwaukee?
Yeah, basically.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. We're talking about, we've done a couple shows on this. It's a very important issue, but we're looking at what was talked about at this Dividing Lines conference at Marquette last week, which was interesting, and then it brought people who probably don't sit at the table very often together, Republicans and Democrats, elected officials who are miles apart, it seems, on all kinds of things, but brought them in to talk about the issue of high political segregation in this metropolitan area, racial segregation as well, and how it's keeping us from moving ahead as a region. And our guest, Catherine Levine Einstein, points to issues like mass transit, water. She looks at job creation, the amount of money that a city needs, the poverty that's evident in cities compared to wealthier suburban areas. It would benefit a region to get together and talk about all of these issues, but it's not happening because of this divide. What do you think? I remember sometime years ago, people suggested, well, what we need is a toll road to come into the city of Milwaukee. If you're coming into the city to work, you got to stop at a toll road, which may be an extreme, but what do you think? Not, don't respond to that. You can, but what do you think about no cooperation? Again, evidence of a huge divide. Which hurts everybody, is her point. Catherine is assistant professor of political science at Boston University. She's working on a book, Divided Regions, Race, Political Segregation, and the Fragmentation of American Political Policy. We mentioned Milwaukee because that's where we are. She grew up here, but her study also looks at other cities in this country as well, particularly in Detroit. She looks at Minneapolis, why things are different there, and southern communities, Santa Fe as well. Here's our phone number. Please join our conversation. Do you agree we have this kind of segregation? Does it hurt the area? Is there a way to work together for the common good? Or is it who the heck cares about the common good anymore? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are filled. If you're trying to get through, go to email, talk@wpr.org, or just wait to call in a little while, 800-486-8655. We go to Sherry in Milwaukee for our first caller. Catherine, hi, Sherry.
Hi, Catherine. You know, I think part of the issue is, and I know her book addresses race as part of it, but race is such a big part of it. I think that a lot of people in outlying areas don't want to help those people, those black people, those poor people. And, you know, the media does a job of making, for instance, Metro Milwaukee seem like it's just this horrible. I had a woman ask me, is it terrifying to drive through the city? I mean, you know, so this is a concern. But the other part of that is, we don't talk about the outlying areas that are having poverty and problems with heroin and financial problems and issues, too. And so if there's a way we can have people understand it's about all of our success economically will help us all, as opposed to they're going to be giving something to those people. I think that's what gets in the way a lot of times. Mm.
All right. Thanks, Sherry. Professor Einstein.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you that race is a huge component of this story. And actually, I do statistical work looking at every metropolitan area in the country, and I look at what kinds of areas are politically polarized. And it turns out that race and racial segregation, and in particular the segregation of blacks from whites, explains 70% of the variance in political polarization.
Wow.
Across the country. And just to put that in context, social scientists are thrilled when we can explain 25% of the variance in something. I mean, to be able to explain 70% of the variance with just race, and, you know, I control for basically every other demographic characteristic you can think of to make sure that it's not some other variable, and basically every control, race is still the dominant explanation. And so I completely agree that tied up in these differences in ideology are concerns about whether, you know, someone who is different from you is going to benefit from a particular government policy. I should also add that race also gets tied into political polarization because demographically whites tend to be much more conservative than blacks. I mean, blacks will vote on average for the Democratic Party at a rate of about 95%. And whites, it's geographically variable, but that figure is lower. And so even if you didn't have these sort of racially coded possible explanations for conservatism, just the political gap between whites and blacks helps us to understand why it is that racially segregated places are politically polarized. To Sherry's second point about poverty in outlying areas, I think that's a huge possible way to assemble these regional coalitions, and that's actually what happened in Minneapolis. The lower-income inner-core suburbs actually made sort of a bargain with central cities, and the state legislators who represented those communities were able to work together and find a common ground because they both were concerned about poverty in their respective communities. And there are actually some sort of nascent community groups in Milwaukee, I learned at the Marquette Law Conference, who are trying to assemble a regional coalition in support of light rail, using the fact that a large number of elderly people in these suburban communities lack oftentimes the transportation means to get around really anywhere, in particular to the central city. And so there's some hope that there might be in these communities a coalition between potentially the elderly and people in the inner city who lack cars in support of mass transportation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely a possibility.
Mm-hmm. So do you find then in other large metro areas that are not as racially segregated as ours, where you've seen more minorities move at least to suburbs that are closer to the city, do you see more regional cooperation in those kinds of cities? Because we don't have much of that here.
Absolutely. And, you know, one example of that is somewhere like Washington, D.C., which has a much higher rate of black suburbanization than Milwaukee, which I believe is among the lowest, if not the lowest, rate of black suburbanization in the country. And so in places where there are higher rates of black suburbanization and minority suburbanization, you know, also Hispanic suburbanization is an increasingly big part of the story, too. We do see a greater degree of regional cooperation, more interest in things like mass transportation, regional agreements on a number of other issues, too. So, yeah, I absolutely think that our low rates in Milwaukee of minority suburbanization play a big role in the sharp political divides between suburb and city.
Mm-hmm. Sherry, thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Richard in Madison. Hello.
Hi. There are two questions I wish to ask. Why does the city of Waukesha, which has run out of water, not cooperate with the city of Waukesha? There are six communities in Waukesha County that are linked up to the water utility in Milwaukee to get water from Lake Michigan. That's insane. Number two, why is the idea of a community tax so silly? When I lived in Maryland, people who lived in Prince George's County and Montgomery County had to pay a commuter tax to Washington, D.C., where they work.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that not possible in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So to the first question, why is Waukesha so reluctant to cooperate with the city of Milwaukee? I think a lot of it is this political divide. I mean, you look at what the mayor was saying at the time, and it was a lot about how, you know, they didn't want to be beholden to Milwaukee. They didn't want to be dragged down by the city. They wanted to maintain their independent Waukesha identity. And so I think a lot of these political issues and potentially you know, the undercurrent of the racial issues that lead to those political divides played a role. And, you know, I think that's one of the more striking examples of a failure of a region to cooperate when it would seemingly be in both sides' interests. I mean, Milwaukee needed the money and Waukesha needed the water. But I think there you can see those political differences between Milwaukee and Waukesha preventing a potentially valuable type of cooperation. To the second point, why is a commuter tax not feasible? I think the politics of a lot of more moderate to conservative leading places makes it extraordinarily challenging to introduce new taxes. I think Americans in general are pretty politically opposed to really any new form of taxation. And now that we already have a system that's so predicated on urban sprawl, it would be very, very challenging to assemble any political will behind a commuter tax. The only way I could really think of where that might be more politically feasible is if you could increase public awareness about just how subsidized roads and things like city parking are by the federal government. I mean, in some ways, we have a de facto urban tax in terms of how much we subsidize things like roads and parking spaces. Don't charge cars for the costs that they're imposing on cities to maintain the upkeep of those roads and parking spaces. Mm. But I think Americans, just politically, that would be extraordinarily challenging to do, particularly in a place like Milwaukee.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. If Milwaukee is heavily Democratic, which it is, it's not going to hurt the leadership of this city to say, all right, we're not getting cooperation. We need to increase our tax base. We have a lot of things we need to take care of, schools and housing and all kinds of issues that are more important in this city and more pressing needs in this city. So why would they care about, couldn't they just unilaterally put a tax on people who are coming into the city who work here?
They could, but I imagine, I don't know because I haven't talked to the business leaders about this, but I'm guessing that business leaders and large employers in the city of Milwaukee would oppose that kind of government regulation, and it could potentially lead to, businesses leaving the city or being more reluctant to locate themselves within the city's borders. I would think that would be the main obstacle to city officials wanting to implement that kind of tax.
You mentioned the conference at Marquette, and you spoke at that conference. I was interested to see the people on the sitting down together who normally don't speak to each other much at all. Did you think that the participants had wildly different ideas about what's going on here? Did they have wildly different ideas about cooperation? Was there a chance that this was going to be the beginning of heartfelt cooperation or not?
So I think that there were certainly some issues that the political officials wanted to cooperate on. You definitely got a sense in that room of there being a desire to move past the hyper-partisan divide and to be able to sit down in a room together and forge cooperative agreements. And the general sense that I got is that cooperation is possible on low salience issues that don't really attract the attention of the public. Mm. And so there's some sort of maybe more bureaucratic, but certainly important to the functioning of a democracy issues where there is some cooperation happening, at least according to the public officials on this panel. But when it comes to really high salience, important issues, again, things like mass transportation and affordable housing, I think those were the two that came up the most. You don't see a lot of cooperation. And there was a particularly spirited discussion about affordable housing and a sort of sharp divide between the Democratic and Republican panelists about who was doing enough for affordable housing. And so, again, I think on it, smaller issues, you may see some cooperation, but at least on those big issues, the political divide really comes into play.
So nothing really changes until a political divide lessens?
I think it won't change unless the political divide lessens or unless you have an entrepreneurial, and I think state officials are probably in some ways the best situated to do this. You know, local governments are fundamentally creatures of the state, and so state governments can, from on high, implement initiatives, even if the local governments can't, work together on these things. And so I think there is room for state governments to potentially put forward things like regional mass transit or regional affordable housing agreements. That's going to be very challenging right now, given the very Republican slant of Wisconsin state government. My research, I found that Republicans, state party platforms largely are opposed to regional initiatives. There doesn't seem to be, particularly from the right side of the aisle, a lot of political support for regional agreements.
So there's no hope there either at the place where there could possibly be move to this. There is
without a new governor, right? That's, I think, going to be, or a new state legislature. I think that's going to be a real challenge for Milwaukee.
Yeah. And yet, when you look at this issue, we may be very, very politically divided, but I've lived in this community for 38 years, and we've been talking about some kind of mass transit, some kind of significant school integration, you know, county kind of response to segregation of Milwaukee schools for a lot longer than since we've had Republican administration. We haven't been able to do this under Democratic administration either, have we?
No, we obviously haven't been able to. You know, we still don't have a light rail system
right. In
Milwaukee. And I think there, you know, there's a lot of things that are unique to the local political culture of Milwaukee and just sort of bad luck in terms of windows of opportunity to implement these kinds of things. You know, we recently had the Obama administration giving away money for light rail,
yeah.
And had there been a Democratic governor
right. At
the time that Obama was giving away that federal money, I suspect there would be some kind of regional transit system. And so I think there's partially these broad systemic factors, which are more what I look at, but then there also are these peculiarities to the metro area and just, yeah, historical timing.
We're welcoming phone calls for our guests and wondering what you think about this. We're talking about lack of regional cooperation, and the result of such cooperation could be a really good thing for people who live in the city of Milwaukee and for people who live in surrounding suburbs, but instead we don't work together and we don't have transportation, light rail, that would allow people to get from, say, Waukesha to Milwaukee without having to be in traffic jams, and perhaps a lot speedier than being on the freeway. Might be better for the environment. And we would have a number of people who can't find jobs in this city being able to go to outer areas where there are jobs, and it would help people to don't have a lot. But none of this seems to be happening here, because of our high political segregation, and our racial segregation feeds into the high political segregation. So Catherine has looked at major metro areas in this country. She is from Milwaukee, so there's a deep understanding of what's going on in this city and what the ramifications are of this kind of high political segregation. What do you think? We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. What would help us look at all of these issues as a community, a common community? Why are we so divided on all of this? Does our ideology, our political ideology, determine where we're going to stand on regional cooperation? And does that make a lot of sense? What do you think? If you live in the suburbs, what do you think about cooperation with the city? If you live in the city, what do you think about the suburbs? What do you think? We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Catherine Levine Einstein, professor of political science at Boston University, and she's writing a book now, Divided Regions, Race, Political Segregation, and the Fragmentation of American Metropolitan Policy. And let's go to Ken in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I tuned in just a little bit ago, so I hope that I'm not repeating anything. But I'm a recruiter, and I have lost count how many times I have been unable to place people who would be willing to work either here in Milwaukee or in Madison or even in Chicago, except for a lack of efficient, high-speed transportation,
really?
Public transportation. They don't want to make the drive every day.
Uh-huh. Isn't that interesting?
It's amazing to me that this is just not being recognized. It is it's a job killer.
Catherine.
Absolutely. You know, from what I've seen and heard, actually, at the Marquette Law Conference, business leaders were largely in support of a regional mass transit system. And I think that there is certainly, at least in some segments of the business community, these exact concerns that not having a mass transit system makes Milwaukee comparatively less attractive than other communities that do provide that kind of easy, non-car-based transport. So, and again, I think the political or the politicization of mass transit and the combination of an unfriendly state legislature and state executive's office and suburban communities, I mean, really sort of shows the political strength and political will of those places to prevent mass transit, given the strong support of obviously the central city and at least some support from the business community.
Ken, do you make your concerns known to the powers that be?
I've tried. Those that would listen, I don't think that they're really open to it. I don't understand it, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're trying to understand it, too, which is why we're talking about it. Thank you so much. It is kind of a common sense thing, isn't it? Of course, if you have mass transit, it's a lot easier to get people, you know, easy way to get to work. You don't have to worry about parking and finding parking, and parking is expensive and sitting in a darn car for a long period of time because that's what everybody else is doing, and you got construction going on, and it's a hassle.
Absolutely, and I think we know that millennials are increasingly choosing more, you know, urban cores, less car-based lifestyle, have a higher preference for, you know, good mass transit links. And so I think it could be a real liability for Milwaukee going forward in, you know, trying to attract young, educated, highly educated talent.
Thank you, Ken, very much for your important call. Tony in Madison, hi.
I don't know if mine's quite as important, but I will say that I think one of the big issues we have is we still have a certain amount of racism. We'll bus kids to schools, but there will only be white teachers. So we have whole groups of people who have never dealt with a black authority figure in any way, in any managerial section. Until we have real equality among the sexes and the races, it's going to be hard to be anything but combative in these issues. And I get it. I don't appreciate it, but I get it.
Catherine.
Yeah, so I think that the really tight link between race and racial attitudes and your political preferences makes it sort of really thorny to convince people to support some of these issues. You know, political scientists have found that a lot of policies become what's called racially coded. And so things like welfare and crime policy are two of the more commonly cited examples, but mass transportation probably experiences some of this too, where there's a certain segment of the population who associates those particular policies with benefiting people who they don't like, who don't look like them. And so as long as you have that kind of racial coding of some of these policies, you're going to have, again, in certain segments of the population, really virulent opposition to things like mass transportation, more lenient crime policy, welfare, things like that.
Mm. Thank you, Tony. In a way, what you say just sort of stops me in my tracks because it's 2014, for heaven's sake, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, shouldn't we be a little farther along?
I think one issue to really highlight is what political scientists distinguish between explicit and implicit racism. And so, you know, taking those jargony terms, explicit racism is what we think of as old school racism, where someone would just say, I think this racial group is lazy, or I don't like people who look like that. And that has largely gone by the wayside. You know, there certainly are some people who still espouse those views, but you know, we see survey evidence, interview evidence that kind of racism is really on the decline. But what some political scientists believe is still very much in force, and actually may have particularly become more relevant with Obama's presidency, is this idea of implicit racism, where you know, seeing impoverished black people on TV or even seeing a black man in the Oval Office may subtly trigger some kind of, opposition to people who don't look like you may trigger some kind of psychological mechanism that leads to this more virulent opposition to a lot of these racially coded policies. That implicit racism is incredibly challenging to measure, and I can't measure it with my data. You know, I look at geographically aggregated data. I don't have the kind of polling data, the kind of experimental evidence that you can use to really get at this fascinating psychological phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But it, there's other research that shows that it may very well be out there, and it may have become particularly relevant, again, during Obama's presidency. But that's still a contentious issue, and as I said, it's very difficult to measure.
Yes. Thank you very much, Tony, for your call. Doug in Maquoneco. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Enjoying the nice weather.
Good.
I want to say that the sewer wars, do you remember those?
Yes.
Remember the sewer wars between Milwaukee and the suburbs? Do you remember what they were about? Essentially, Milwaukee, it was regional cooperation. All these same buzzwords mm-hmm. you guys are using were used then. Milwaukee then got the suburbs hooked up, and then they changed the rules and said rather than, because it had always been by how much water you used that determined your bill, they changed it to be on the value of your home. Well, that's not what the suburbs signed up for. And in the end, now they're paying based on the value of their home, which are much higher in the suburbs than they were in the cities. That killed any hopes of regional cooperation right there. And one other thing, the thing that Scott Walker killed was not commuter rail. That was high-speed rail. Two totally different arguments. It wasn't for getting from Milwaukee to jobs in Waukesha. It was for getting sort of quick from Madison to Milwaukee.
Well, the high-speed rail would have stopped in Waukesha.
It would have stopped in Gerkey's Corners, yes. But it wasn't. It was not a commuter rail system. You still would have needed to have gotten from the terminal there in Gerkey's Corners to get out to where the jobs were. There aren't really that many jobs in Gerkey's Corners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then another thing is, I look at as a suburban person, I look at Milwaukee and I see incompetence. I see the mayor wanting to build a light rail system that runs around on the east side. That does nothing. If he had some common sense and said, listen, let's build some light rail, let's work together when they rebuild 94, like the L in Chicago, let's run light rail right down the middle of it. We've got some money towards that. Let's get a start towards it. But instead, he wants to waste it. And you can't say that light rail system he wants to build is going to serve anyone. It's not going to take anybody to any jobs. It's just going to run in a circle.
Catherine.
I actually think that that's probably a very fair point that a light rail to the east side of Milwaukee is not going to solve a lot of the major issues that we've been talking about on this show. When we're thinking about regional mass transit, the light rail would need to cross jurisdictional boundaries. It would need to go to the places, in Ozaukee County and Waukesha County, where we are seeing this massive job growth. And it would need to go to places that are not currently accessible by Milwaukee County buses. So I do think that having sort of a smaller light rail is probably, at best, a very temporary solution. And I will say that my research looks more broadly at what's going on in metropolitan areas across the country. And so I don't know the in-depth political history of the mass transportation battles in metropolitan Milwaukee. I will say that my suspicion is that Mayor Barrett would love to get light rail out into some of these western
yes.
suburban communities, and
yes.
that I don't think the major obstacle to getting light rail into Waukesha County is a lack of vision on the part of Milwaukee officials. That I do think the bigger component there is opposition in those suburban communities to having mass transportation stop there. And we see this not only in mass transportation, but in affordable housing. The New Berlin affordable housing lawsuit by the Department of Justice is a clear example of the opposition of suburban communities to a lot of these different kinds of initiatives. And so I will say that I acknowledge the certainly there are examples of bad urban planning that have happened in the city of Milwaukee over the last couple of decades. But I don't think it's fair to put all of the blame at the city's feet.
Yeah, well, what you need is you need, and mayors for a long time in the city have been talking about a need for that kind of transit to get people to jobs. I mean, that's nothing new. Everybody's saying that. What you need is the governor and people in Waukesha and people in Milwaukee to all sit down and agree that this is important for all of us. You know, it's not, that seems to be what's lacking here. What about his point on the sewer wars and whether or not we should be charged according to how expensive our houses are in suburban areas, the value of the home, or it should not be tied to the value of home, just how much water you use. He says that that really resulted in a crumbling of any kind of regional cooperation. Would you go that far?
So I think it's a really interesting point because it actually links really nicely to what I've seen in metro areas across the country and in suburban areas, what their sort of number one concern about working with city governments is, and it's this concern about cities financially dragging them down. It's this concern that cities are, again, these tax and spend locations that are irresponsible, incompetent, and sort of can't be trusted with the financial health of a region. And there's this large sense that people moved out to the suburbs to avoid those kinds of urban challenges. So, you know, I do think that it fits very well with what I've seen in other places, about why it is that suburban areas don't support regional cooperation. And I think going forward, if we do want to have regional cooperation, there really needs to be an effort to help to eliminate those perceptions, to really work to show why it is that regional cooperation is potentially beneficial. And I think it's really important to highlight, too, the large number, historically, of federal government subsidies that have gone to suburban communities to help to understand why it is that those places are sort of supported by the government in ways that might be sort of less visible, that we don't just have cities as taking resources from the federal government, from suburban governments, that there has been real support from the government for suburban localities too, and that there can be benefits across municipal boundaries from regional cooperation and greater government involvement.
Thank you, Doug, very much for your call. Let's go to Nathaniel. It's probably the last call we'll have time for. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Go right ahead, Nathaniel.
Yes, I'd like to bring to the awareness of the guest speaker that there really is no substantial welfare in Milwaukee. There's only a food share benefit of maybe $29.50 a week, a little over $100. But government assistance is at a minimum.
Government assistance, I don't know, the phone line was not terrific, but government assistance, not much for people who don't have much. Catherine?
Yeah. I think that that's certainly an issue broadly with the federal government retrenchment, that there's a really high level of poverty in Milwaukee, and, I think there is certainly a struggle on the part of local, state, and federal officials to meet the needs of individuals there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call. Thank you, Catherine, for being with us. When is the book coming out?
So I am hoping to finish it up this summer and have it out sometime next year.
All right. Good for you. Thank you so much for being with us and for doing your analysis of, well, of a lot of places, but particularly for doing an analysis of what's going on here. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest this hour of the program, Catherine Levine Einstein. She's from this area. She's assistant professor of political science at Boston University, and she is author of the forthcoming Divided Regions, Race, Political Segregation, and the Fragmentation of American Metropolitan Policy. And we thank her for looking at this region. She spoke at that conference last week, Dividing Lines series. I think that's when we interviewed Craig, wasn't it? It's hard to keep up with days. Time flies, huh? Time flies. Craig Gilbert was with us last week to talk about the conference and his very interesting series, which is in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Marika Subal for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.